We're here with Tim Decay.
Hi,
again.
Tim.
Hi. Second round, round two. You loved us so much, I came back
for more.
You
yes,
did.
Yeah. We're very grateful because we know your schedule is very busy.
Well, so it's wonderful to be here and just chat with you guys about who knows what.
Yeah, we have no idea where this is going. We haven't planned anything, so this is just going to go in.
We're traveling into the unknown.
And yes, exactly. How have you been since the last time we spoke to you?
2 days ago.
I've been good. Since the last time we spoke, I bought a house. So
okay.
Well done. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I don't have to tell people where I'm living, but are we still neighbors?
We are still neighbors.
I'm so happy.
Roughly. Yeah, we are.
Because we've always lived in the same area.
We have, haven't we?
Yeah.
Studio City-ish.
You just gave it away.
It's a big area.
But Los Angeles-ish.
Yeah. That kind of
California-ish.
Thing.
California-ish.
You know, around that way.
The globe.
Indeed.
What I was just telling Dan before we turn the mic on is because I just came off this 5-day mimicking fast, which Dan introduced to me ages ago.
I don't know how do people do fasts?
They give you food. This particular one, they actually give you food.
Really?
And so the last time you were here was actually my worst day. It was day 3, wasn't it? And
You should have seen it after you left. Oh, my God. Dude, yeah. I just had to put up with it.
I have that effect on people sometimes.
I was like, I feel like shit. I'm going to die.
How many days? Five days?
Yeah. It's a mimicking. So what the food they give you
mimics.
Your body thinks it's actually fasting when you're eating food. So it gives you the benefits of fasting without
starving
yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like low 800 calories, like food. That's how
soups and crackers and
stuff like that.
So today is my first day off.
Yeah.
And I decided I was going to be clever today because this is my third time doing it and I've always had trouble with day 6, what to eat after. And so I decided to buy a bunch of baby food.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Like jars of baby food?
Actually little mac and cheeses and raviolis that are meant for 12 months and up and little, you know, little niblets.
That's a good idea.
And so
dog food as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Come on.
No, she's not eating dog food.
I'm not eating dog food. The story that Dan's so
referring to.
The story is, and you'd never met my dog before he passed, did you?
No.
Okay. Well, I took him to a pet store, and I used to buy him nice treats, and they gave away samples. And the owner of the store said, does your dog want to try this little snack? And I said, sure. And she goes, by the way, you know who really eats them up are the owners. I said, what? And they said, it's human grade. And,
And
I said, I have to try this. So I gave my dog a little bit. I had a bit and I said, oh my God, it's the best cookie I've ever had.
No.
And it's all natural, made with honey and completely human grade. So I used to buy them in these large packets.
For yourself.
Yeah. So it was like one for you, one for me.
And for him. But my dog was so smart. And you have dogs, but my dog was so smart. He actually used to look at me when I used to pop one in my mouth. Like, woman, that's mine.
That's mine. What do you do? Where was this? Was this the in North Hollywood?
Were you a starving actor at the time?
Sherman Oaks, no.
Like super starving actor at the time?
No. It tasted better than an animal cracker.
So to that, we give our dogs canned dog food, you know? And there's one.
I'm hoping this goes somewhere.
There's one particular can that is, I don't know, it's called chicken stew or something.
Uh-huh.
Every time I open, I think, well, that looks pretty good.
Have you ever?
No,
oh,
no. But it's
disappointing.
It's all white meat. And yeah, I've seen that.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It looks delicious. Yeah. It's chunky.
Well, I remember now that we're talking about it, I remember when I was younger, I would eat, like, you know, we had cats, and I would eat a little bit of the cat food just to try it out.
Ugh.
Oh, that's disgusting. Okay,
cat. Really? Back then, it probably wasn't human grade.
Probably not. Probably. But I was a kid, and so I was like, yeah. Here you go, Maxine. Yeah. What's this?
How was it?
No, because like fatty. Back then it had, it probably was fatty. I think some of them, like, you know, you could see like the bones in there and stuff like that. And I think, I didn't eat the bones.
No.
I don't think I did.
Yeah.
I can't remember really. But limits. I do remember that I did. Yeah. There are limits to that.
I didn't eat the bones.
Yeah.
What are you, crazy?
I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tim had a dog who unfortunately passed recently, but this was a funny story, the German Shepherd.
Oh, yeah.
You have to tell that story.
There were quite a few stories.
The hugging. Because German Shepherds are very protective. They're known to be protective of their owners.
Mm-hmm. So we had a large German Shepherd named Duke. And if you didn't want him to attack you, or not attack you, but the best thing to do would be to embrace whoever came to the door.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So
he would know that. Yeah. Family.
The plumber would come and it just, hey, Dave, you know, big bear hug.
Just go with it, man. Yeah, just go with it. Trust me.
But people I would just meet.
Really?
Somebody would come to the door to give an estimate on something or whatever. I said, look, I know we just met, but I need to hug you. It's better for Duke.
It's
better for everybody if you see that.
You probably made so many people's day, though.
No, I don't know. Yeah.
But Tim said this to me recently.
Like, you rubbing yourself against
phone.
Me, man? What are you doing?
No. But Tim says, because I said, how is he? And he goes, unfortunately, you know, he passed. But he goes, but I'm still going to hug people at the door. Some pretty girl walks the door, so I hug.
Yeah, give me a hug. Yeah, my dog around the corner. He won't come around and see you. But, you know.
But we have to hug for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Your hair smells like cinnamon.
Nobody comes to visit anymore for some odd reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
I'm going to come to visit now that you have your new house.
Yeah. It's going to be fun.
I can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I can see Dana again.
Does it have a pool?
So she remembers.
It does have a pool.
Hey.
Yeah, it does have a pool.
Go you.
It's a pool and...
The door.
Door.
There's a bathroom in there. Maybe a couple of them.
Lots of space. No. We're going to put this... I'm going to share this. So there are four bedrooms upstairs,
mm-hmm.
master and three others. My daughter has chosen what room she would like from the three others. That's cool. She's got another couple of years. And I thought, okay, of the remaining two, there's one that's pretty cool. I think I'll use that for my office. And then the other bedroom will be for our son when he occasionally comes home.
Yeah.
To which from my
Yale.
Wife said,
it's like me.
To which my wife said, oh no. No, he has to have the larger room. He has to have the nicer room, and the office is in the small. And
is I the said, son but, the favorite of the wife?
The son and the daughter are there. If you took a total,
is that all your kids?
If you looked at our family,
mm-hmm.
and somebody made a totem pole of our family,
yeah,
my wife would be at the very top, and the paint would be bright, and the image of her is. Just beautiful. And then the kids and then after the kids, their images are beautiful, the dogs, and then they're at the very bottom where the grass is growing. And it's like, oh, is that still part of the totem pole? Or is it just the base is some semblance of me?
Awesome.
That's our family dynamic.
But to finish the story, your wife said,
James has to have that room. Well, he needs to be able to put his baseball stuff and his guitars somewhere. But honey's never going to be here. He'll be here at Christmas, and he'll be here maybe spring. No, he won't be here for spring break.
He'll be
playing.
In spring training, yeah.
Mm. So then I shared that with her mother, and they're 100% Italian. And her mother said, not kidding at all, with great seriousness, oh, you can never give up hope. meaning, well, you could, I mean, the son may return and stay there.
The prodigal son
may return and stay.
Is that an Italian thing? Like, we want the family to continuously be together?
I think so. I think it harkens back to a multi-generational living situation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is awesome in some regards, but...
Well, in today's day and age, like the son and the daughter at one point will probably come back and live with the parents for a short period of time.
No kidding.
Yeah, I did it.
The cost of living is so much higher.
Yeah.
And,
jobs are harder to get.
Jobs are much more difficult to get. And but yet you've gone to college or some secondary education that is, probably has a loan attached to it. Oh, yeah. I know quite a few very educated and versed people in their field can't get a job. And they're not even actors.
Yeah. And then when you get to actors, it's like just a much bigger pool of people.
It's like it's too expected. That's a given. We're out of work more than we are.
Your job is not to be an actor.
Which I think it makes us much more resilient.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to
struggle. I had a teacher who once said, Bill Esper was his name. He just passed away a little while ago. But Bill would say, you have to have the hide of a walrus and the soul of an angel to be an actor.
Yes, to handle. By the way, I did something. The last time we met, I had a coaching that evening, and I thought about you because, as I told you before, Dan, Tim was my acting coach early on. You're a brilliant one. You actually taught me a lot.
Oh, thanks.
So, but the last conversation we had, we were talking about you have to be very well versed in camera.
Yeah.
And so I've been teaching this new girl, and she's a natural camera actress. First of all, because she knows, I mean, she just seems to get it. She understands it right away.
Do you think that's the younger generation? Because they're growing up with cameras and phones and all that sort of stuff?
No, because I have...
She's wagging her finger at me.
No, because I have other people her age, and they don't understand it. But she still struggles, and she finally stopped me, and she goes, Romy, it just feels so mechanical. Mm-hmm. And I said, let me put it to you like this. I had a genius moment that I wasn't expecting to come out, but I'm going to say it here. Maybe somebody else said it.
Genius moment, ladies and gentlemen.
I said, I said, your major scene partner when you're a camera actor, actress, is the camera. Mm. No, even if you're with other people, humans in the scene, that camera is so important to be there. You still have to speak their language. Mm-hmm. And for the camera to understand you, the camera is a machine. Therefore, that's why you feel mechanical in your movements, because the camera's understanding you. And she got it instantly.
Oh, good.
And but it was just funny because I realized, ooh, I'm a genius. Maybe I'm not.
I'm going to write a book.
But
yeah. I think you certainly have to know where the camera is and
how to look at it.
Yeah, or not look at it.
Or not look at it. No, when to – exactly.
Because you're never going to break the fourth wall, but
– not looking at the camera, but how to act with it is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I never have them break the fourth wall, but I also say I never want something to look like it's an audition. I want it to look like the camera just – or a fly in the wall happened to glimpse this moment in this character's life.
Yeah, it's Michael Caine said something in this piece.
Acting in film.
Yeah, acting in film. I thought it was great.
I love that
book. You guys may remember it. But he would say the camera is your best friend, your lover, your mother, the person who loves to watch you and just it adores you. And your job is to know that and ignore her or him, because that's I think it touches to what you were saying as well. It's important to know that the camera will get it. You've got to allow it to get it.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that from The Game? You know that pickup book?
No.
Romy's like, what? What are you talking about? Do you know that book? The Game. It's called it was written by this guy who's like a pickup artist.
Yeah.
And it's all about psychology and like the best way to like pick up women and all that sort of stuff.
Well, everything is psychology. Yeah. You know, I always say, you know, you can always look at somebody's body language and their actions. You know, don't listen to what they're saying. Mm. Words lie. The body can't.
Mm. Mm.
In everyday life.
Mm.
So.
That's deep. We're getting deep, but going down the rabbit hole here.
It's the subconscious that... Anyway, I just wanted to say, because I was very proud because I thought about you. And I thought, I need to tell Tim this.
At first, it may seem mechanical, but then after a while, you know, it's like driving a car. Like, okay, I've got to think about this and do this and this and this. And like, if you think about it, all the stuff you needed to learn to drive a car. At this point, you have to, you know, yes, second gear, all that. And then after a while, it's just second nature. And so that's why it's mechanical for her at the first.
That's quite right.
Yeah. And then after a while, it just makes sense. And especially if you're on set for a long period of time, I think it just starts to become
second nature.
Natural for you. Yeah.
That's a great analogy because
I agree.
It's not natural to sit down, press your foot a little bit, and move forward.
Yeah.
Driving is not a natural thing.
Oh, God, no.
But yet, it's imperative.
Yeah.
For like, most parts of the
world. And you know that you...
A little too imperative.
And you know that you've it's become second nature when you get home. You go, how the hell did I get home? Like, you just kind of do it automatically and, you know...
I never want to be in your car. That's all I'm saying. If you can't remember how you got home when you were driving.
Well,
Thank you.
Yeah. But it's just like, you know, you're driving along and you just naturally know there, Lefer, okay, that car's... The brakes has gone on, so I probably should slow down here and all that sort of stuff.
All
and
that goes on at like, the same time.
Yeah, because at first you're like, okay, I got to do this and I got to put the clutch in because I learned manual when I learned how to drive.
So did I.
I was like, okay, you got to put the clutch in, you got to put it in second gear. Okay, and when I'm going around here, I'm going to put it in third. Yeah. And look in the mirror and look right and the person next to me.
It's a lot.
Ticking things off. And
they all seem to be just as important as all the others.
Yeah.
There is no order of importance.
Yeah.
But isn't that with any skill? Because I think you both. Mm-hmm. I played the violin for 19 years, so I started when I was, I don't know, 4, something like that, and I kept on for a while. I suck now, so don't ask me to play.
Aww.
But I just remember playing, and it was so.
You can't suck after 19 years of playing.
No, you can't.
You just maybe a little bit of.
I'm rusty.
A little bit out of rut. Yeah,
you're rusty.
I'm rusty. I couldn't play Mendelssohn like I was playing before. I could probably squeak out "Happy Birthday" or "Twinkle Twinkle Little Star."
I would be impressed with that because if I did it.
No, it sounded like that the last time I was home.
Do you still have one?
Yes.
Nice.
I still have all my violins, actually.
You will have to play it on the podcast.
Absolutely not.
Yes, you will.
I don't want to.
No, you're going to do it.
Break anybody's ears.
No, we can do post production stuff.
Yeah,
so, you know, bring it down.
It's amazing what they can do.
But I will say because I've been playing for so long, you know, it did feel like very mechanical at first, and of course, at the end of a long time playing, it seemed like second nature. But I can tell when I watch something who is actually a violin player and who not. I know when a bow should be up or down, you know, which is such a subtle difference.
Yeah,
well, I guess I'm always like, oh my god, they're not even faking it well.
Yeah,
who taught you?
I guess that's like musicians watching people play guitar on movies and things like that and all that sort of stuff. Or piano.
Piano.
Yeah.
And yet, it's so cool when the camera is on somebody playing piano and there's no cut. And you go from their face down to their hands
and they're just smashing
it. Oh, he's really playing or she's really playing. I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was what they did at the Green Book.
Well, I want to ask you because he did. He did learn how to play, but he also had a piano double. And but they had so many scenes like where he said it didn't. I love that movie, by the way. And it didn't cut. And I was – but then – if you look at the behind the scenes, there was a double.
He did have a piano double. That? What he learned to do, and I think he learned to do it really well. I think he had a modicum of piano playing knowledge, but he would really listen, really strongly listen to a song that he had to play, watch how it was played, and could fake it extremely well.
He did it so well.
And fake might even be too strong a word. He would play it. If we heard what he played, it's probably sounded not good.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say awful, but it looked great. And it looked as if he knew what we could move his fingers well enough to have us think that, oh yeah, that goes – that he's playing the notes that I'm hearing right now.
Yeah.
Like Adrian Brody in The Pianist, because that happened as well. You saw his fingers.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was amazing in that.
Yeah, it was a great, great movie.
I don't think – I've seen The Pianist, but I haven't seen it for a long time. I haven't seen Green Book.
Oh, you have to see that. There's a reason why it won Best Picture.
Yeah. Controversial, apparently.
It's just a lovely story, and it's a character
and it's
piece.
Fun.
And it's
the chemistry between the two actors.
It's kind of movie you don't see these days. It reminded me of movies like Midnight Run with Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro, and these I would call somewhat of a buddy movie.
Yeah,
but it had a it just was a kind of movie that's, again, not made.
It had a lot of heart.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Yeah. And she was wonderful.
The wife.
Yes. Oh, and she's in Dead to Me Now with Christina Applegate.
And she was in Avengers. She plays Hawkeye's wife.
Linda
Cardellini.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good
she
work.
Was in Bloodline. Too. Yes. She was great.
She was also.
I love that.
She does also a lot of played, comedy stuff.
She also played Whitney in Legally Blonde.
Yeah. Supposedly, she's this great comedian.
Yeah. Because I think I've seen her in, what was it? Let's Be Cops.
Really?
Yeah. I think she was. I think she played also as well. She was in New Girl. I think she was Jess's sister. If I'm thinking of the right person, I could be completely wrong, so anybody out there can correct me when they listen to this. But I think, yeah, I've seen her do a lot of kind of comedy stuff. And
I love
then,
that.
And then she pops up. And
yeah, she was wonderful. I love her.
Yeah.
And it's great now that – actually, I want to ask you because this we had put it out on Instagram, what do you want to hear from people? Hmm. And because you're an actor, I want to ask you two questions, and I'll tell you the two. One is, how is the diversity movement affecting you now? Mm. And also some of your struggles. I know you talked about seeing your face up close and that's it, but really some of the struggles. Like I was telling Dan the other day, I had 7 cents in my account once to last me 2 weeks and I'd been fired from my job. And so that kind of sucked and I had to sell everything that I owned.
Yeah.
So do you have any stories to recount?
Oh yeah. A number of them. It's funny. I remember the feeling of the struggles more than I remember the feelings of the successes and the joys for whatever reason.
I actually think I took a memory class once and they actually said, try to, when you make a list, associate something with something bad or kind of weird. Like for instance, if you make a grocery list, you have the long-term memory in your hard drive and then a short-term memory. And so, for instance, your bedroom, you would know your bedroom very well. You live in it.
Are you a memory palace? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's called a memory palace.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, okay, so if you need to buy eggs, sugar, and milk, just think, okay, your dresser, eggs. And think of you like smashing eggs and like doing all sorts of crazy stuff with
your
it.
Eggs are
against
dancing.
The dresser, you know. Weird stuff. And you in it, but I. They said something.
Also, the more perverted or the dirtier,
the more you remember it. So I think that goes back to you remember traumatic things.
I think so.
Bad things more, or the struggle more than you do the.
It's the overall because I think you're in the struggle more than you're not, as an actor, and I can knock on wood and say I've had a successful career and I've made a living and I've. You know,
you have 4 bedrooms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I get
and a pool
and I get
and a
kids.
Pool.
Yeah.
And, a hugging dog.
And a hugging. Right. But, and yet, there are more times when you're not working. And yeah, I think than you are. Sometimes some years will go by where, oh, I'm working all the time. I actually need a break. Doesn't happen too often. But one of the struggles that I have and continue to have, and It reminds me of when I guest starred on a show called Standoff, and I played an air traffic controller. Air traffic controllers have a ton of adrenaline. It's a high stress job because you're in charge of all these lives up in the planes, and they're on your screen. But there's an adrenaline that rushes through you when you're an air traffic controller. They have the highest rate of suicide after. Going into retirement because they've just spent their whole life being high and in control. And now, you know, they can't deal with deciding whether or not to get juice or milk or whatever. I mean, it's an exaggeration.
They can't take the mundane.
Yeah.
But so part of my struggle has always been, you know, after a show, after a run of something, after whatever, and that goes all the way back to theater. Just, oh man, I'm glad to be home. I'm glad to be, you know, back with my family. And yet my wife, you know, there's always that point where she says, you need to get another job because I'm just.
You sourpuss.
Right.
Get out of the house.
And I don't think.
You're sitting around in your underwear.
And as I get older, I try to. You try to develop some kind of mechanism to to push away that melancholy feeling of post show.
I have heard from a lot of people, they say get like a hobby or a side thing or something like that to just keep you going.
Yeah, during another
those
passion,
lean,
just
during those long periods
dive
and stuff
into
like
this.
That. Yeah.
And for me, it was my kids. And it's interesting. Now that they're getting older, they don't need you as much.
They will always need you.
Well, yeah. They need,
just
but
during
in a different
this,
way.
In a different way.
They don't need as much of your time.
Yeah.
They need your money.
Yes. Yes.
I probably talk
and they
to
will
my,
always need that.
I probably talk to my mom more now than I ever have. But I don't know if that's because I'm an actress and I'm constantly, I need support. Not financial support. I need emotional support.
Yeah.
I want to get that from her.
I try to talk to them as much as I can, but there are times where I don't want to let them know that I'm struggling and having a tough time.
Oh, yeah.
So, because I don't want them
to worry
because they've got their own things that they need to deal with. So,
no,
I probably don't let them talk to them as much as I should in that regard.
And the other thing is, you learn early on not to tell them what possible projects you have in the works.
Oh, why is that?
Because every phone call. Well, did you hear about that movie? Did you hear? You'd be perfect for that role. Why? Oh man!
Oh, let me go in there. I'll tell them.
Oh no!
What my mom
I was
going
to say my mom has a different reaction every time I'm on a veil or I have a pin in me. She goes, "Okay."
Well, that's good.
But I agree with you, Dan. I try not to when I'm really upset. Like and want to cry and put a gun to my head, kind of upset. I never call her. Yeah. It's only the things that I feel like I can't share with anybody else, but she'll understand.
Yeah,
because she's my mother.
Mm-hmm.
But then I finish off with saying, "But Mom, I'm fine. Mentally, I'm fine. I just need to, you know, talk this through with you."
Yeah, because as a parent, that's all you want your child to be is happy, and you don't care if whatever that means to your child, that's what you want. And if they're not, it hurts, physically hurts, and you're wondering, how can I fix that? How can I make that better?
Mm-hmm. Does,
so your instinct to not tell them, it's quite dear because it's
dear.
Clear that you care for them, you love them, and so you don't.
Sometimes
there's nothing that can be done, and so then you're just sitting
there. Yeah, because there are times where I'll eventually tell mom something, and she goes, "Oh, I kind of knew that something like that was happening." Because
the mother's instinct.
Yeah, because you either didn't talk to me as much at this particular time or this and this and this. How is that, I was just going to ask, when you sometimes you can't fix it with your kids? What is that like?
It's
because I don't know, because I don't have any kids, I don't think.
It's awful.
You feel helpless. You feel. I mean,
do you have kids?
I had a dog who was my kid. No, I mean, this is really weird for people. No, a lot of pet owners.
Not in LA.
Yeah. Okay. But a lot of people understand. And in fact, I saw a post where it said, you know, about how each person has an animal soulmate, whether you meet them or not in this lifetime. But I was never a dog lover. I had cats growing up and I was attacked by a big dog when I was young. So even a Chihuahua, I would freak out. When I saw him on the street at a rescue, it was like my heart just opened up and was going to explode. And we imprinted on each other. Whereas I had never liked dogs before, I couldn't financially afford a pet. If I was going to get a pet, it was going to be a cat. Didn't know how to take care of a dog. And I just knew, I said, I am his mom. And he knew it too, because instantly he could not leave my side. Hmm. And it was this feeling of always wanting to protect him. When he got sick and I couldn't protect him, and sometimes I didn't have enough money, and how do I afford this, you know, vet bill or something? I felt like an absolute failure. I thought my whole world was crashing down. And I used to say to him, I said, I'm so sorry I couldn't be, you know, more for you, and I've let you down. It wasn't about me. It was completely unconditional. I went without food so I could feed him.
Mm.
You know, I went without sleep so that, you know, I could nurture him. I missed auditions. I used to feed. I was a hospice at the end. I was getting teary because I would feed him from, or give him water from a dropper. And I didn't want to leave his side. And the day that, you know, I knew he was going to leave, I knew that was going to be the hardest day of my life. And my mother, who was never a dog person, but when she saw us together, she goes, I see you two together and I understand it now.
Oh, really?
Because I used to talk about it and she never got it. But when she finally saw us together, she goes, ah, and she felt the same way about me. And for her to see that was extraordinary. And then when I told her, sorry, Mom, you know, he was the person, the thing, the soul that I loved most on this earth. And I still miss him to this day. I think about him every day. And she was a little affronted. And she's like, what do you mean? And she goes, more than me? And I said, well, he was my child. I said, do you love me and Eric more than you love Grandma? She goes, okay, I get it. And that was it. But not everybody has that experience with a pet.
Yeah.
He was the first pet that I've had that I considered my child.
With that, like, because you, there was that struggle towards the end of your dog's life. When the pup finally passed, was there this weird sense of relief that he was no longer struggling and stuff like that? We were talking about this the other day friends of ours have had like some family things happening and stuff like that. And it made us get into a conversation of like, for example, my grandfather had a stroke and my grandmother was just looking after him around the clock. And then he finally, like, it got to a point where he wanted to go.
Yeah.
And when he finally, like, passed away, like, my grandmother was like, there's this weird sense of relief of, like, it's so emotionally exhausting looking, you know, doing all that sort of stuff. And then the relief of, like, this person's no longer in pain.
Yeah. Yeah,
but also, do I do now as well? But,
there, I mean, you grieve, of course, and it was the first. I've never felt that kind of grief before. When I cried, my best friend at the time said to me, "I've never heard crying like that ever. This is the first time that I've ever witnessed a soul in pain. This is a soul breaking, and my soul broke, and it was awful, but." But I was, and I just whispered in, because I took his body home and waited for the mortuary to pick him up because he was going to be cremated. And I just kind of held him, his cold, lifeless body. But I just held him to my chest and I just whispered, I said, you're free now.
Mm.
And my only regret was that, because as I mentioned to you, I think both of you at one time, all the vets said he would make it. They didn't think it was as serious as it was. My only guilt is that I had him hold on for as long as he did, because I think I would have put him out of his misery much sooner.
That's another thing we were talking about, that, like, mm-hmm. as amazing as the medical profession is today, like, we delay people probably naturally passing. Like, are we doing it for selfish reasons? Yeah. Like, you know, we want to keep this person alive even though they're in great pain, but we don't want them to go. And I think it's an interesting conversation to have,
so,
you know.
We certainly don't want that on ourselves.
No.
But that may be the right move to admit that.
That's hard.
It's very difficult.
That's disgustingly hard.
It is. Because a doctor, she'll be able to say, well, my job is to keep grandpa alive or grandma alive. That's mm-hmm. my job. Your job is to decide whether or not you want to continue that whether or not grandma or grandpa are comfortable or happy.
Yeah.
And that's why you have all of these preconditioned, I can't remember the term, but basically it says, if I'm in that situation, pull the plug.
Or you take them to another state where you can do assisted suicide. My mom actually said that. She goes, if I'm ever a vegetable, she goes, you bring me to, I think, Colorado. Is it Oregon or one of those states up there? Yeah. She goes, you bring me there. And she made me swear that she did not want to be in pain towards the end of her life.
I don't think anybody does.
Yeah. Oh, but by the way, I totally interrupted you. But diversity movement.
Yeah, we went down a very different...
Yeah, sorry about that, guys, but... The diversity movement, how has it affected you? Because I know you get offered things, but do you feel like with this diversity movement, where everything's just a little bit more balanced, that you're being overlooked for things in favor of, say, like an Asian actor, Latino or African American or Black?
That it has affected me. And I would say in the last 5 years or so. Yeah, the offers usually come with a clearly it needs to be somebody like me. Mm. But if or usually an offer comes from somebody I've worked with before or whatever, but when it could be me or it could be
when it says any ethnicity,
an African American gentleman or an Asian gentleman, whatever. That it will go to, most of the time, it will go to not me.
How do you think, to a certain degree, of course, being ethnic, I love the balance because I wasn't given opportunities. I was always overlooked early on. And so finally now is a good time for me to come out of retirement. But I will also say, from a producer standpoint, I also feel like it's a little unfair because sometimes the job will go to an actor that is less deserving just because they are diverse. Mm-hmm. And I always think to myself, I love what's happening, but I always say choose the actor who's best for the role and for the job. But I mean, maybe.
You'd like to think that, but
it's not happening, yeah.
But what Harry said, he said there's money in diversity now. So it comes down to, once again,
there is.
Financial.
There is. I was just going to say, money in diversity.
Yeah.
And that you can. Look, maybe somebody, I would be more right for a role, but because of another agenda, which isn't certainly not wrong, you know, because of another agenda, and along with that agenda comes a financial motivation. Certain things are going to happen.
But also,
listening on NPR, they were having a conversation about advertisement, and the commercials, a gentleman was talking about how the commercials in England, he said, are not indicative. They're very ethnically diverse, but they're not indicative of the demographics of England. Mm. Mm. They're not, they don't correlate to the ratio.
Okay.
They overcompensate for it. And he had an issue with that, but he also understood why it was being done.
Yeah, it's like the pendulum has completely swung the other way, and it needs to happen, and then it, you know, over time it might balance itself out.
Well, I think so.
The pendulum always balances itself out. I mean, you see it just, remember when reality TV was a huge thing? A lot of actors were, and this is before we had 1,000 different channels and opportunities for scripted television, but everything was reality TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it was the devil. The reality TV was the devil.
And it destroyed a lot of.
And it just, the pendulum had swung, and now it's balanced out. There's still reality TV.
There is, because it's the only kind of appointment television you can have other than sports. But yeah, in the end, look, we love to be told the story. It's one of the oldest acts of man is to tell a story.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, that's yeah, exactly. Like, that's how we communicated.
Yeah.
And I heard, like,
religions formed because of stories.
Like, I remember reading that, like, say, for, like, gossip. Gossip was very, very important back in the day.
Yeah.
Because gossip was a way for you to protect each other, kind of like, hey, I just want to let you know, this person over there, be careful of that person. And that's how kind of gossip became what it was. I mean, now, obviously, it's used for, I mean, it's used because sometimes gossip's fun. And I mean, that's what all those, you know, like entertainment shows and things like that, like Entertainment Tonight. Yeah. Is that still on, Entertainment Tonight?
I think it is.
I used to watch the shit out of that when
Access
I was younger.
Hollywood.
Is it Access Hollywood now or something like that?
I think they're both still on.
Yeah, well, like TMZ. Like, that's gossip. Yeah. Everybody loves the crap out of that, even though that's like an advertising machine that people can kind of go, okay, I'm going to pay you this much money and then you pop over here and all that sort of stuff and things like that.
Have you ever been caught on TMZ doing something embarrassing, Tim?
No, nothing embarrassing.
Or Dan.
No.
TMZ would come up and go, out of the way. We're trying to get this person behind you. That's what TMZ would do.
No, nothing embarrassing, no.
Okay. But they have caught you. They've stopped you.
One practical joke I played on somebody.
What was that?
Oh, I pretended to arrest Matt Nix, who wrote Burn Notice. And so Jeff Easton, the creator of White Collar, had me pretend to arrest him. And there was a camera, and we called TMZ to make sure they saw it. It was all fun. So nothing embarrassing.
Nothing. Is it, I think, because I think, isn't Ashton Kutcher bringing back Punk'd?
Is he?
I think he is. I don't know if he's bringing it back, but I know Punk'd, I read that Punk'd is coming back.
I love that.
So, you know, watch out, dude.
I know.
Shit's going to happen. You're going to get arrested for something. TMZ is going to pop up, you know, say some stuff.
But it wasn't me.
It wasn't me, my
God. I love to Punk'd people, but I. But the problem is I can never keep the joke. I always like, oh, I can't do this.
Yeah. What are those four guys from Brooklyn, Impractical Jokers? They're fantastic. They're very funny. What they do is they make one of the four go into public and embarrass themselves. They don't embarrass other people.
Oh, okay.
And it's great. And they feed the guys. One of the guys has an earpiece and the other three are in the back, wherever the back is.
Yeah.
Saying,
in a van.
Now tell her that you really like the way she does whatever. And it's incredibly embarrassing.
Doesn't
Ellen or Jimmy Kimmel do that as well?
I think it's both of them, I think, probably do it.
Hilarious.
Have you seen the one, the hypnotist? This one time. So I think, what was it? The hypnotist, he hypnotized somebody for the person to wake up and believe they're in a zombie apocalypse. And they had this person like in an actual kind of like thing. Yeah, they went full kind of thing. So they did that. I can't remember how that went. There was also another one on YouTube where the daughter just came back from I think getting her wisdom teeth or something like that out, and the brothers were punking her. Yeah, punking her about the zombie,
the end of the world has happened.
And she's like, ah!
And they're saying, who do we save, the dog or the cat? She's like, the cat.
Oh yeah, they're all out there. Yeah, that's.
Do you
hilarious.
Think you could be hypnotized?
I have been hypnotized.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done hypnotherapy. I mean, I don't know if I've been like, you know, not on stage kind of hypnotized or anything like that, but I did do some hypnotherapy, and you're just lying there and like this is particular kind of music playing in the background. The guy's just reading this kind of thing, you know, like you're getting, you know, you're going deeper and deeper and deeper, and you know, your hands are like stuck to the
And that worked for you?
Yeah, it did. It
worked
for me.
Because it never worked for me. I'm someone who can't. What about you?
And I couldn't lift my, like, he said, what happens is you want to do it, but you just kind of go, eh. And that's kind of what hypnosis is. Like, I wanted to lift my arms off the sofa, but I was just like, no, they're stuck. I'm not going to do it. And that's kind of what.
But some people can't be hypnotized.
Yeah, I think you have to be. I think you have to want to be hypnotized.
I
think so too.
I definitely want to, and I've tried multiple times with multiple people. It does not work, and they'll be like, "Okay, you're under," and I said, "No, I'm not." I will say that. I said, "Nope, didn't work," and then
punch in the face. You're under.
But it's just because I would love to do that just as an experience.
Yeah, but something in your body is saying no.
Yeah, there's something in there. Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Tim?
No, I've never. The closest I think that I would love to be hypnotized, I would love that. I always think of hypnotism when I'm about to go under at a dentist's office or something like that, and I have to count backwards. I'm at 100, and I always think, oh man, I'm not gonna fall asleep, and I'm gonna feel the scalpel, or I'm gonna feel whatever. But of course, you know, you're like 199, and then. The next moment, you remember a nurse waking you up saying it's all over. But
Did you fly with the nurse?
Yeah. Pardon?
Did you fly with the nurse?
I don't know. Maybe.
I did one time.
Well, you don't know because I actually hypnotized Tim. He actually initially said no to the podcast.
Really?
Oh. And here you are.
Here I am.
I just want to say. And one, two, three.
Oh, I got to get out of here. What am I doing here?
You're drinking our water. That's what you're doing here.
Yeah.
You're taking our water. I think, on that note,
let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
Tim, can you leave us with a quote that you've kind of lived by?
I don't think of a quote every so often, and I read If by Rudyard Kipling to my kids once a year on their birthday. But there is a great letter to Agnes DeMille from Martha Graham, and I'm reading it. There is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is or how valuable it is, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep open and aware directly of the urges that motivate you. Keep that channel open. No artist is pleased. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer, divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others.
Oh, wow. And on that note,
nice.
Tim, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Twice.
Yeah.
We loved having you.
Loved being here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Take care. Have a good day.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.